chapter 3. In our series through the book of James, this is message number 7, entitled Faith in a Forked Tongue. We'll be looking at James chapter 3, verses 1 to 12. My brethren, be not many masters, knowing that we shall receive the greater condemnation. For in many things we offend all, and if any man offend not in word, the same is a perfect man, and also able to bridle the whole body. Behold, we put bits in the horses' mouths, that they may obey us, and we turn about their whole body. Behold also the ships, which, though they be so great, and are driven of fierce winds, yet are they turned about with a very small helm, whithersoever the governor listeth. Even so the tongue is a little member, and boasteth great things. Behold how great a matter a little fire kindleth. And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. So is the tongue among our members, that it defileth the whole body, and setteth on fire the course of nature, and is set on fire of hell. For every kind of beasts, and of birds, and of serpents, and of things in the sea is tamed, and hath been tamed of mankind. But the tongue can no man tame. It is an unruly evil, full of deadly poison. Therewith bless we God, even the Father, and therewith curse we men, which are made after the similitude of God. Out of the same mouth proceedeth blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not so to be. Doth the fountain send forth at the same place sweet water and bitter? Can the fig tree, my brethren, bear olive berries, either a vine, figs? So can no fountain both yield salt water and fresh. So I thought about, with this passage, obviously, talking about the tongue and our words, our speech, I thought, well, I'm going to go to Proverbs to read verses about our speech, sort of set the stage for this passage. But then realized that about one-third of the verses in the book of Proverbs in some way relate to our speech. So that adds up to over 300 verses. So that's quite a lot. But Proverbs speaks to the power of words for good or bad. Proverbs speaks to how that the use of words and the control of our speech or the lack thereof marks wisdom or folly. Proverbs chapter 15 and verse 28, just to give a few verses. The heart of the righteous studieth to answer, but the mouth of the wicked poureth out evil things. Proverbs 13:3. He that keepeth his mouth keepeth his life, but he that openeth wide his lips shall have destruction. Proverbs 10:19. In the multitude of words there wanteth not sin, but he that refraineth his lips is wise. The tongue of the wise, probably this is Proverbs 15:2. The tongue of the wise useth knowledge aright, but the mouth of fools poureth out foolishness. So consistently when you read through the book of Proverbs, wisdom is related as having control over the tongue, over our speech, restraining our speech, speaking right words at right times, being silent at right times. And then fools are consistently portrayed as just always and immediately just speaking their minds and speaking everything that they think and all that sort of thing. Well, even in the New Testament, Jesus warned in Matthew chapter 12, verse 36, "But I say unto you that every idle word that men shall speak, they shall give account thereof in the day of judgment." Now, this is a very small sampling of what the whole Bible has to say about our speech, and it has a lot to say about our speech. But it's enough to make us think about our words more carefully. This is especially true for preachers and teachers, those that would stand before others. A preacher that preaches three times a week will speak about a million words in a year in front of the church. A Sunday school teacher that teaches weekly will speak about a million words in about 4.5 years. Those are just the words from a pulpit or just the words that are spoken in front of a class. And of course, Jesus tells us we'll have to account for every one of them. Now, likewise, we're all going to have to give an account of our words, whether they be good or bad or worthless, or whether they be public or whether they be private. And that certainly is a sobering thought. Now, James has already referred to the bridling of the tongue back in chapter 1 and verse 26. And in fact, he refers to the tongue or to our speech in some way in every chapter of this letter. Now, he deals with this subject directly here in this opening passage of chapter number 3. And at the end of chapter 2, which is the passage we looked at this morning, James was addressing whether faith and works can be separated or can be disconnected. And his contention from the very start is that faith that is without works is dead. And this is not the kind of faith that saves. So faith and works, as James shows in that passage, are necessarily connected. They cannot be separated because works are the natural product of faith. Works are produced by faith. A faith that is a true faith that James is talking about is the kind of faith that produces good works as defined by the Bible. And then James said that we are justified by works because they are the natural product of faith. They are the only evidence of true faith. So words alone are no evidence of true faith. And he spoke about a saying only faith. Words alone can signal the lack of faith or that faith that is disconnected from works. He used Abraham as an example of how that we are justified by works. So righteousness was imputed to Abraham by faith or because he believed according to Genesis 15:6. And then as a result of Abraham's faith, he obeyed God and he kept his word, even to the offering up of Isaac in Genesis chapter 22, verses 10 to 12, where he gave evidence of the authenticity of his faith. So works, James says, are a completion or the proper end. They are the result of faith. So had Abraham only claimed to believe in God, but had not obeyed what God had commanded him to do, Abraham's faith would have been dead, and Abraham wouldn't have been justified. And this is what James is talking about in James chapter 2. So if the faith that we profess does nothing but produce words, then that faith is false. Now, this is not to say that we never stumble, that we never sin, or that we always flawlessly obey every word of God's word. But if we have a true and living faith, the point is that good works will be produced. There will be obedience that will be present. So now we come to chapter 3. And here in verses 1 and 12, James is proceeding in this letter to address the control of the tongue or our speech. And it might seem like that James is making a hard change of subject here, but it is more closely connected than that. And one reason we know that is because words are also works. Now, Jesus said that we will be judged for our words. And James didn't speak against words in chapter number 2, but he did say that words only, words by themselves, words that are not joined with actions are worthless. So the words spoken earlier in chapter 2 to the people that are cold and hungry and words that are spoken, it says, well, you know, be warm and filled, but are not joined with the actions of actually giving them the things that they need and cannot get on their own. Well, those are empty words. Those are worthless words. But James didn't say that all words are bad. He didn't say that words have nothing to do with faith and works, but that words alone cannot substitute for works of faith. Now, another reason we know that there is still some connection here is that James is still concerned, as he is throughout this entire letter, with the authenticity of faith, what is true and genuine faith. Remember, he started out back in verse 14 in chapter 2 that we looked at last time. He started out talking about, well, if any man says that he has faith, any person can make a claim that they have faith, but he says, but if they don't have works, then that faith is dead. So James is concerned with the authenticity of faith. Words are also works that are produced by faith, and our use of them is another test of the genuineness of our faith. So as we look at this passage in verses 1 to 5 concerning our words, James will speak about keeping our lives on course, and in verses 6 to 12 about finding olives on a fig tree. So let's begin here in the first part here in verses 1 to 5 and keeping our lives on course. Verse 1, my brethren, be not many masters, knowing that we shall receive the greater condemnation. So this word is translated masters here. It's actually a word that means teachers. And it seems like James just brings up teachers out of nowhere. Just all of a sudden, why are you talking about teachers? Now, the word that he uses here for teacher, it is commonly translated master, particularly in the King James. It's this word, as it's used, is actually most often used in the New Testament of Jesus. So you find it most often within the gospel accounts, actually referring to him. And those are not always from people that necessarily believed in Jesus, but those that recognized him as what we would refer to as a Jewish rabbi. Now, the word itself that's used here for translated masters, it refers to a teacher, it refers to one who gives instruction. And it does have something of a formal sense that it's referring to an office, a recognized office or position. And in other words, someone that has the necessary skill and the necessary training that are in a position of teacher. Now, Paul used this term twice in his letters to refer to God's gifting for churches. So 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 28, and Ephesians chapter 4, and verse number 11. So the first century churches had apostles and they had prophets. Of course, the New Testament wasn't completed yet until right at the end of the first century when the apostles and the prophets were, John being the last of those, were dying out. They had the apostles and the prophets, and they also had teachers in the churches. And teachers were responsible to teach the Old Testament and the apostles' doctrine. So like 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse number 2, Paul told Timothy that he was to teach others what Paul had taught him. So teachers were those that were to teach the Word of God, and it was a part of being a pastor or an elder. It's one of those terms that is associated with that same office as well. Now, if we look at what James says about teachers, in other words, my brethren, be not many masters, knowing that we shall receive the greater condemnation. If we look at what he says here about teachers, we can see that this is different than the hypothetical scenarios. You remember there were two that we had previously in this letter where James talked about there's two men comes into your assembly, one's rich and one's poor, and you treat the rich man better than you do the poor man, and you're not being a doer of the word of God to do that. The other was that you had a brother or sister, one of your own number in the congregation that lacked the basic daily necessities that they needed of life, and you spoke comforting words to them, but you didn't give them those things that they needed. So those were two hypothetical scenarios. In other words, James wasn't addressing a situation that was actually then happening within these congregations at the time. But this reads different when you come here to chapter 3. And in fact, as you get a little later in the letter, it does seem that James is addressing a few specific issues that may have been an issue in the Jewish remnant congregations of that day. So it seems that, as he says this, that there were among them many that were desiring to be teachers in the churches, many that were wanting to hold that office. And the term for teacher was similar to Jewish rabbis within Judaism. And we can also see the connection because being a teacher, in other words, why James is talking about teachers, because it was something of a problem within those congregations he's writing to. And then also because being a teacher means publicly using words, and the control of our words and our speech is something that's difficult for everyone on some level. Now, the reason that James gives is stated here at the end, we shall receive a greater condemnation. He's going to expand on this throughout this passage, but greater condemnation means a stricter judgment, a closer scrutiny. So those who stand before others in a position of teacher and those who speak these words publicly are going to be judged more strictly, going to have to give an account more strictly than others. Why? Because a teacher takes on responsibility for those who are taught, takes on responsibility for accurately teaching God's Word, which is what we have today in the 66 books of the Old and New Testaments. Let's go to verse number 2. For in many things we offend all. If any man offend not in word, the same is a perfect man, and able also to bridle the whole body. Now the word that he uses for offend here is a word that it can be used to mean sin, but when it's used that way, it's in a more figurative sense, because the word literally means to stumble. It's a word that's describing tripping over something. And I really think that's what James's intention is here. He's saying we all trip up over many different things. All of us, James says, we all trip up over that. But he's going to expand this passage beyond just teachers. And we can see that there's still a special consideration for teachers, that they be characterized by control over their tongues. But James says, there are many ways that we trip up, but not to trip up in our speech is a mark of maturity. So he uses that word perfect. We've seen it used a few times already in this letter. It refers to maturity, refers to completion, that sort of an idea. And when we join this with the previous passage in chapter 2, we could say that control over the works of one's tongue shows connection to true faith. In other words, he has talked about maturity as a completing, a fulfilling of true faith. And so in this case, that would be evidenced by control over one's speech. And control over the tongue, James says, is control over the whole body. Now, the point that he's making is the difficulty in controlling the tongue. We can do a lot of things more easily. We can control our minds by learning new skills, gaining new information, that sort of thing. We can exercise some control there. We can have control over our bodies through exercise and fitness and diet and that sort of thing, even a discipline of rest. We can have control over our body, but all of that is easier than controlling our tongues, not speaking when we shouldn't, not saying things that we shouldn't, speaking our minds, speaking whatever comes to mind. Well, it's not a mark of wisdom according to Proverbs. Proverbs 29:11, a fool uttereth all his mind, but a wise man keepeth it in until afterwards. So it is the one area of life that I have found that us more introverted people actually have an advantage. One area, I think, where we actually have an advantage. Now let's go to verse 3. Behold, We put bits in the horses' mouths that they may obey us, and we turn about their whole body. So James begins the first of two illustrations that he's going to use here. He's referring to a bit and a bridle, a bit, the small piece of metal that goes in the horse's mouth, connected to the bridle, to the straps. And with that, the horse is controlled. Of course, a horse that's been trained and what have you. But his point is that we can use a small thing to control an entire horse and to steer it where we want it to go. I mean, I don't know how much of you, how much you've been around horses. I really haven't a whole lot. Just a very few times that I've gone horseback riding, and I still remember the first time that I went was a teenager, and I mean this horse just seems so huge, and I get up on this thing, and I mean I was a little bit nervous just thinking, what am I going to do with this thing? You know, I mean it's going to do whatever it wants to do, and they tell you to do this and do that, you know, and the horse was very well trained, and I didn't have any problems, but at any moment, you know, I just had the sense that this horse could do anything that it wants to, and I'm not going to be able to do anything about it. So with such a small thing like a bit and a bridle, this entire horse can be controlled, it can be steered, it can be directed, it can be turned around, all of these sort of things. That's his point. Then his second illustration in verse 4, behold also the ships, which though they be so great and are driven of fierce winds, yet are they turned about with a very small helm, whithersoever the governor listeth. Large ships are controlled by relatively very small rudders. And with it, the steersman can turn this large ship wherever it is that he wants it to go. So once again, something very small that can control something very large. And then we get the point in verse 5. Even so, the tongue is a little member and boasteth great things. Behold how great a matter a little fire kindleth. So the point is that something small can control something much larger, something seemingly much more powerful. Now, on the one hand, he's telling us that there is great power in our tongues, and our tongues can build up, our tongues can tear down, our tongues can do good, our tongues can do a lot of damage. The tongue is small, but it has the power to control essentially a person's entire life. In other words, the tongue can ruin even something that seems good that we do. So think back to James 1:26. He said, if any man among you seem to be religious and bridleth not his tongue, but deceiveth his own heart, this man's religion is vain. In other words, all of the religious practices that he may observe and keep are all undone because he has no control over his tongue. Now, on the other hand, if we think about what James is saying here, if we can control our tongues, then we can also have great power to control our lives and to do much good. So yes, on the one hand, it's a very powerful weapon, you might say, and it can do a lot of damage. But when it's controlled, and when it's directed properly, and when it's steered correctly, it can also do a lot of good. Well, it brings us into the second part of the passage in verses 6 to 12, where he talks about the olives on a fig tree. Let's look at verse 6. And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. So is the tongue among our members, that it defileth the whole body, and setteth on fire the course of nature, and it is set on fire of hell. All right, so the last part of verse number 5 introduces the destructive power of the tongue with the imagery of fire. Fire can start with just one tiny little spark, and it can destroy vast acreage of land. It can destroy great and mighty buildings. It could bring down, destroy a city. Fire is so destructive, and it all can just start with one tiny little spark. And I remember growing up, the wildfires that we would have there in the mountains and things, and so oftentimes just one little spark. Sometimes maybe a strike of lightning would start something, but sometimes it could be just as much as somebody throwing a cigarette out of a window, and just something very small, and just acres upon acres would be turned into just stubble, really. So the implication is that fire, it is very powerful, and again, it's a power that can do a lot of good when it is used properly, when it's controlled, when it is directed. You know, a fire in the fireplace in the wintertime is a great blessing. Fire in the stove that we can cook and heat things that we need to, whatever, it's a great blessing. You know, fire in the middle of the floor in the living room, not so much. Very powerful, very destructive. And James plainly says that the human tongue, it is a fire. It is that spark. Now, he goes on to describe it as a world of iniquity, referring to the potential for evil with the tongue. And as such, it defiles our whole bodies. Now, when you're looking at verse 6, it actually has some very difficult phrases in it. The mention of iniquity and the world and hell at least associate the tongue with forces of evil and associates its negative work with them. So the exact phrasing is a little difficult in this verse. If you go to the Greek scholars and their commentaries and other translations and all that sort of thing, it doesn't really clear it up. There's some difficulty in trying to sort of sort out what exactly it is that's being said. But it's evident as we read this and read this in its context that James means for us to understand that our tongues are very powerful, but they're also naturally inclined to destructive evil. Now we go to verse number 7. For every kind of beasts and of birds and of serpents and of things in the sea is tamed and hath been tamed of mankind. So all kinds of animal life, he's saying, has been tamed, and the use of this word tamed doesn't mean like domesticated. It doesn't mean they've been made pets. That's not the point of what he's saying. But he's saying more like curbed or subdued, or we might even say neutralized or restrained in some way. In other words, wild animals pose a certain threat to human beings, but all of those sort of threats have been dealt with in one way or another. It's been accomplished, these wild animals, as big and as strong as they are. He says, but in verse 8, but the tongue can no man tame. It's an unruly evil full of deadly poison. So the contrast with the wild animals then is that the tongue is even more difficult to restrain. It's more difficult. It's untamable in essence. It's unruly, he says. It's venomous. And the point of the comparison is that the tongue is actually more deadly and more difficult to control than the wildest of animals. Verse 9, therewith bless we God, even the Father, therewith curse we men, which are made after the similitude of God. So James here begins a list, and he's going to go through verses 9 to 12, and he's going to bring out what I would describe as the doubleness of the tongue. The forked tongue, the double tongue. You remember back in chapter 1 and verse 8, he talked about a double-minded man. So here, in a sense, we could say it's a double-tongued man that James is pointing to. He says, the same tongue blesses God and curses men. Now the point, he says, that men are made in the image of God. So men and women are made in the image of God. To curse them is ultimately to curse their maker, their creator. Now, the word for cursing here, and he's not talking about shouting profanity at them. The word for cursing is a very strong word. It's stronger than merely just wishing them ill or maybe wishing something bad to happen to them. It's much stronger than that. It's more akin to wishing evil on someone, wishing damnation on someone. Very, very strong language. Verse number 10, out of the same mouth proceedeth blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not so to be. James's point is the contradiction. There's a contradiction that these two things are coming from the same source, the same mouth, the same tongue. And he's going to proceed to illustrate this with illustrations of contradiction in nature. So he starts in verse 11, doth a fountain send forth at the same place sweet water and bitter? A fountain or a spring, James says, cannot simultaneously give both good and bad water. So if we think about it, water that is only contaminated to a very small percentage is still dangerous and perhaps deadly, depending on what the contamination is and what the levels are. But again, just a small concentration of contamination in the water is enough to render it dangerous and again, even deadly. And so James is saying it's impossible for a spring to have both good and bad water that is coming from it. If the source is contaminated, then the whole is contaminated. Verse 12, can the fig tree, my brethren, bear olive berries, either a vine, figs? So can no fountain both yield salt water and fresh. So another illustration of an impossible natural contradiction. Fig trees bear figs, not olives. Vines, they don't bear figs. It's not something that they sometimes do or don't do. It's something they cannot do. And he's not obviously talking about some of the hybrid crossing and all the sort of things that might go on. But by nature, the tree or the vine bears the kind of fruit that it is. It cannot do otherwise. It's a contradiction of nature that's not possible, just like with the spring of water. So by the time that we've got to the end of this passage, especially these last verses here in this passage, we can certainly see the connection with the end of chapter 2. So James has contended in this letter that true faith produces works or produces fruit. And just as it is in nature, fruit is only produced according to its kind. So an apple tree bears apples. It doesn't bear grapes. A grapevine bears grapes and it doesn't bear apples. True faith produces the true fruit of faith, which is good works. So in this case, true faith produces good words as works. A maturity of faith then means a control of the tongue. Now James uses the imagery that he did, he connects this to teaching or being teachers. It actually echoes the teaching of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 7, verses 15 to 20. Beware of false prophets which come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravening wolves. Ye shall know them by their fruits. Do men gather grapes of thorns or figs of thistles? Even so, every good tree bringeth forth good fruit, but a corrupt tree bringeth forth evil fruit. A good tree cannot bring forth evil fruit, neither can a corrupt tree bring forth good fruit. Every tree that bringeth not forth good fruit is hewn down and cast into the fire. Wherefore, by their fruits ye shall know them. Jesus was warning about false teaching, and he directed us to look at the fruit that is produced to determine the source, because it is vitally connected. It is dependent upon. And good fruit comes from a good tree. Likewise, good words come from good faith.